Yo soy Bhagavan Sama Sambuddho Suakato Yena Bhagavata Dhammo Supatipanno Yasa Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Dhammaya Bhagavantam Sadhammam Sasangam Ime hi sakha vehi atarahak Aropite hi abhipujayama Sāduno bhante bhagavā suchira parinibhutopi Pachima janata nukampamanasa Ime sakare dugata pannakarabhute patikanhatu Amhakam dikaratam hitaya sukhaya Alahang sammasambuddho bhagava Buddhang bhagavantam abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammam Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Sanghaṃ Namāmi Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammā Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammā Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammā Sambuddhassa Iti piso bhagava arahaṃ sammā sambuddho Vijja-caraṇa-sampanno sugato lokavidu anuttaro purisa-dhamma-savati satta-deva-manu Sāna Buddho Bhagavā Tamahaṃ Bhagavantaṃ Abhipujayāmi Tamahaṃ Bhagavantaṃ Sirasā Namāmi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sanditiko akaliko ehipasiko opanayiko pachatang veditabo vinyuhi tamahang dhammang abhipujayami tamahang dhammang Sirasa Namami Supatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Ujjapatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Yāyapatipanno Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho Samichipatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Yatitam Chattavi Purisa Yugani Atta Purisa Pugala Esa Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakineyo Anjalikaraniyo Anuttara Punyaketang Lokasa Tamahang Sangang Abhipujayami Tamahang Sangang Sirasanamami. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, upwards anamade, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, freed from drowsiness, one could sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false use, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Oh. Okay. Very good. So let's get into these questions. Oops. Okay, that's not that many. Question number one. Dear Ajahn B, which one is that? It's got B on it. What is the name of the book by Anita Murujani that you talked about yesterday? I don't know, what's it called?
Dying to Be Me.
Dying to Be Me? Okay. Yeah. Okay. If all the questions were easy like that, we'd be done on time. What do we do if someone on retreat has a birthday today? Who do you reckon it is? It begins with a H. Okay, come on, you start it. What? Stand up, Harry. Hey. Okay. Now, just to make it nice and fair, anyone else has a birthday any time this year? Okay, that's a special one. Happy birthday to you, Harry. Anyone else? Okay.
Yesterday.
Okay.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. To you. Hey.
Okay. Anyone else?
Next week.
Sorry?
Next week.
I don't know what date it is.
I think we better take it to hospital. Is that a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday?
Actually, it was 2 days ago. I forgot.
Okay, again. No. Yeah,
very good.
Dear Ajahn, how to overcome not being able to sleep after meditating at night time? Sometimes if you get lots of energy because you've meditated deeply, then really you don't need to sleep. What you do, you lay down, relax the body, and you meditate laying down. The four postures are sort of standing, walking, sleeping, and lying down. And sometimes you do lots and lots of meditation, doing able to lying down posture is really helpful because it stretches the body, it's very comfortable. But the way to do a lying down meditation, if you really want to meditate and not to fall asleep, is find a posture when you lay down that you don't normally go to sleep in. So I think many of you heard what my little method, which I developed over the years, over the decades. When I want to meditate, I lie down on my back. Because I don't usually fall asleep like that, so I lay down on my back, and it's nice and comfortable. I usually don't use a pillow, because that makes it more like a bed to go sleep in. Lie down on my back, nice and comfortable, and just be aware of my body, relax the body. And because my body's not used to going to sleep like that, it never does. And if I go to sleep, it's usually on my right side or left side. That's how I go to sleep. Been practicing like that for years. And so I have a special position for my body where I can do lying down meditation. But if you've got lots of energy because you've been meditating and you need to go to sleep, don't need to. Just relax the body, that's all. And you can always, if you make a mistake and you need to go to sleep later on, you can always sleep during my talks. That's what people have said. Now, I'll ask you what you think of this, but what they say is that they can't go to sleep without listening to one of my talks. And to make the point even stronger, there was when we went to the last Global Conference on Buddhism in Berkeley, in California, so 2 or 3 years ago now. Then they introduced me, or this MC, she was a woman, and she said, "I know Ajahn Brahm very well. I go to bed with him every night." I said, "What? I'm a lawyer." And then, of course, I knew what she was up to because she told me earlier that she listens to some of the talks on a recorded talk every evening. And that means that she can relax and she goes to sleep that way. If it works, why not? But anyway, that's understanding why, if it's a lot of energy, then that's one of the reasons why, because you're just fully charged. But sometimes, you know, you've been meditating here, you're not really fully charged, but you go to bed and it's very hard to sleep. It can be all sorts of things, but nevertheless, don't worry about sleeping. The body, I trust my body. If the body really needs to sleep, it will just sleep. And so you can find a nice quiet time, lay down, and you'll fall asleep. You don't worry so much and think, "Oh my goodness, I haven't slept much last night. If I don't go to sleep now, oh, I won't be able to give the chanting. I'll start the chanting. This is what should be done." And fall asleep while you're on camera. But in that same monastery where I thought I was enlightened, found out I wasn't, the abbot there, he had this amazing ability that he would give a talk, you know, when it was time to give a talk, and usually on the moon nights, he'd be sitting up there giving a talk, and all the other monks were listening like you're listening that now. And then he would fall asleep during the middle of his talk. Honestly. He just stopped talking. And it was only maybe for like short naps, maybe about 3 or 4 minutes. And then he'd wake up again. But the amazing thing was, because it made it interesting, the talk was not that good, but what was really interesting, that where he left off, he actually began again. He never thought, "What was I talking about before?" You know, he was saying that these are the four noble truths, and the first noble truth. And there'd be like 5 minutes gap. Honestly, I'm not exaggerating. That's what it was like. It was weird. He kept his continuity, but we had to wait for these gaps in between. And we never knew exactly how long it would be. He couldn't sort of just go off and go to the toilet or somewhere or mess around. So you had to wait there, but it was amazing. So anyway, the sleep thing. If you worry about not being able to sleep, the worry keeps you awake. If you think, "Oh, it doesn't matter, I go to sleep, I don't go to sleep, it's all the same." And I always remember, just especially on a meditation retreat, it's very valuable, wonderful, special time here. So you don't really need to worry about sleep when you're here. You can always catch up when you're in your coffin. And then you have plenty of time to sleep. No, that didn't work, did it? Anyway, sometimes I get a laugh there. But it's the truth, it's the worry which agitates the mind and keeps you awake. If you have something you have to do tomorrow, which is very important. Uh-oh, you muted me again, did you? Okay. Ah-ha-ha, we suggested this. Oh, no, it's only supposed to be a joke. Poor old people in Singapore. We thought that we'd mute the live stream or Zoom, whatever it is, so that next year we don't have to do it. Is that true? You're in trouble now, Leha. No, it's okay. We haven't really done much deep teachings yet, mostly singing happy birthday. But if you are tired, and then you can just any time of the day or night just go and have a rest. But if you worry about being sleepy, then of course, you know, you can't go to sleep. How should a Buddhist deal with negative people? Run. That didn't get much of a joke either, did it? My goodness. Deal with negative people. Depends how negative. There's the old saying that you never love a tiger close up. You love a tiger at a distance. And if people are very negative, you get to know them first of all. And then if they're very dangerous, then of course get out, because if it's abuse or abusive relationship, it's going to be very hard for you to deal with. And don't get angry at them or blame yourself. It's just that sometimes this happens in life. But also, that if they're not too negative, and if you know you can't really escape from them because they're your father or your mother or your sister or brother or something, one beautiful way is to notice that people, there's not such thing as negative people. Such a thing doesn't exist. There's people who have negative times and positive times. There's no one who's sick. They have episodes of sickness. There's no people who are crazy. Sometimes they're just incredible wise people. So we judge people way too easily. And the story behind that for myself was just when... because I didn't have many friends who were Buddhists when I was a student. One or two, but that was it. And so when one of my friends, he was a Christian, and he said, oh, we're just with a few of my friends, we're going to do some social service. We're going down to the local hospital and see if we can volunteer to help out with people suffering from Down syndrome. And as soon as he said that, we had these great discussions and arguments about religion. And as soon as he said he was doing this good thing, and I realized I wasn't, I thought, oh my goodness, I'm in trouble now, I better go as well. So I volunteered also to go to help out in the local hospital, Fulbourn Hospital, outside of Cambridge. And I was just doing that to fly the flag for the Buddhists. They're not going to outdo me. If you can do that, I can do better. It was just pride and ego, that's all it was. But then, when I went there, I learned so much and got so much joy out of just spending a one Thursday afternoon a week at these classes for Down syndrome people who were institutionalized. They should never be institutionalized. But anyway, they were there. Because when you saw them, I said, these are really kind people here. And they were sensitive as well. And that was one of the main things which I just... It was one day, and I had to get the bus from town to this place outside of Cambridge and then just walk quite extensive grounds. And as I was walking to the unit, one of the Down syndrome guys, they saw me, and they went running up to me. And I couldn't understand this at first. This was 40 years ago, 50 years ago. And they came running up to me and gave me this big hug. They'd never done that before. I went, what are you doing that for? And he said, oh, what happened to you? Wow, do you know that? Because the night before I'd broke up with my girlfriend. How he knew that, I just blew my mind. He could see with my physical gesture, my deportment, that I was sad and kind of depressed. And he picked it up straight away. I never forgot that. How sensitive he was. And after that, my respect went up enormously for him and for all the other people who were supposed to be looked down upon as being incompetent, can't fit in or whatever. I thought they were great companions. So much so that I look forward to going there. It was not a social service that I was doing for them. I was learning from them about what these days you would call emotional intelligence. They can pick up so much. So that also taught me that negative energy, negative people, it's mostly what you impose on those people. You make them negative. What you see in others is what they show you back. And it's also, please understand where I'm coming from, but sometimes when is husbands and wives, partners, they have difficulty living together and they come and see me. And some of these, I've known these people, and as far as, that's a really nice guy. It's a really nice girl. What's the problem? And sometimes it is that just they get in these habits of seeing the negativity in one another instead of seeing the beauty in one another, the peace in one another, the happiness and good qualities in one another. They're there. I can see them. When they come up and say, oh, just, I can't stand this guy. He's got so many defects in him. And then I said, yeah, I agree with you. He's got lots of defects. But then so have you. To the wife, you're a match. They don't like that. So that's with negative people in this world. But if it's like, I don't know, what other negative people? Because it is fascinating as a monk, a senior monk, you get to see famous people sometimes. And especially I was fascinated just by people in power, like presidents and prime ministers and even the Queen, Queen Elizabeth. I must admit I was very, very impressed with her. She was old, but she was very alert. Her mindfulness was huge. That was really impressive as a Buddhist monk. But I think it also helped that she didn't really have much power. So she couldn't make decisions, and difficult decisions. But then other people did have to make difficult decisions. And one of the people who I was very impressed with was when he met, I think you all know, the Sri Lankan Prime Minister, Mahinda Rajapaksa. And I'll never forget that because he invited me, I was getting well known, he invited me to come to the palace where he lives. He had to go through lots of security because the Tamil Tigers were still blowing people up and blowing things up, and so was his army too. So anyway, when he got through that security, went into the place where he lived, he was offering breakfast for me. And he'd obviously just got out of bed because he was rubbing his eyes as he came to see me. And just, he did the nice respects. And the first words he said to me, well, I'll never forget. And he said, I'm a failure. And he was, I think at the time, he was one of the most popular prime ministers, also presidents, in Sri Lanka. He's executive president. He said he was a failure. And then I asked him why, and he said he joined politics in order, this is what he said to me, in order to solve the problem with the Tamil insurgency in a peaceful way, in a Buddhist way. And he said he couldn't do it. So it turned into violence. But I always remember what he said first of all, that I'm a failure. And he was the president of a country, and he was incredibly powerful, and he was very well respected at that time. But anyway, he made up for it because afterwards when he gave me the breakfast, he served me himself with baked beans. I don't know how he found out that I like baked beans. But he obviously had a very good secret service which gave him the important intelligence to run the country. We also meet other people, and some of the other people that I've met, you wouldn't want to be in you were in the same room, but it was really sort of scary people. I shouldn't really say who they are because I may go to that country and may disappear. But anyway, but you wonder sort of, in so many people, many of those people, underneath all that external just failure and the fear, and there's a really big heart. People really want to try and do good. They're not evil people. Just our media just loves to put people in those boxes and never allow them to come out of those boxes. So anyway, how to deal with negative people? Be kind to them. Show them kindness. Even all those people in jails I've seen. Probably the most notorious criminal I've ever seen was what was his name? Over there in the east of London, Ronnie Cray. I think they made a film about him or something. He was a bit psychotic. But anyway, and he was notorious in that part of London. And anyway, I went to see him in prison once. He's just this really nice guy. And he said, oh, yeah. If I ever have a couple of quid, I'll send some to your monastery. He never did, but he was genuine about that. the very fact that, you know, that you felt so so respected by him. That was weird. So anyway, with negative people, be kind to them, if you can, and see in them their goodness, their kindness. If you see their goodness and kindness, that's what brings them out, their goodness and kindness out, encourages them. I have read that being around positive people makes you positive. Yeah. So if you're around COVID positive people, that makes you COVID. That's poof. Makes you COVID positive. No, the other one is, that's the old saying, follow wise people, kind people, good people, it makes you wise. You follow sort of negative people, and it gets to you after a while. It's like you soak in the bad energy. I have a grumpy, negative, complaining co-worker. What you should do to them is see if you can get a little collection, you know, from the other people who work with them, the complainer, and send them on a retreat. We hereby sponsor you to a 3-day retreat with someone, not me, please. No, it's with anybody, don't mind. Because if you send them on a retreat, it works. They get associated with really good people. No, I don't want to be here. And that has happened. A few times I've asked, did you come here on your own free will? And I remember this guy said, no. My wife sent me here. I'm not interested in Buddhism or meditation, but my wife sent me here. I said, oh, just relax. And he did, had a good time. So I don't want to be negative like him, your complaining co-worker. You don't have to be. You stand your ground. Be positive. And also, see if you can find... Oh, what's that story from jail? This is from Cardiff Prison Farm. Because I like sort of, you know, proving things. When people challenge me, I say, no, you're wrong. I said, no, you're wrong, Ajahn Brahm. So let's have a test. And this was the time when there was this one of the prisoners over in Carnet. I was in there for a while. And he told me, he said, that, you know, it's okay being kind in the, you know, outside world, but being kind in prison, people think that's weakness. You get beaten up. You get abused. It doesn't work in here. And I said, really? He said, really? He said, I don't believe it. Let's have a test. And the test we had, a silly test, I asked him, who in this whole prison is a person that you hate the most? And it was one of the prison officers. He's a dog. Real dog. Worse than that. I'm sorry to I hope I don't upset any dogs by comparing him to a dog. Dogs are much nicer. Or whatever. And he went on like this for a while. And he said, well, why? Well, he does these really cruel things. He said, just the last week, there was one of the prisoners in Carnet, and his wife came to visit. This prison officer was one of the heads of, you know, this unit. And so he saw the prisoner's wife coming at a check-in. And prisoner never expected his wife to come that day. And it's hard to get to Carnet. It's hard enough to get here. And this is a bit further in the bush. And so that he sent this prisoner to a part of the farm where there was no PA system. So that when his wife checked in and the word came out, prisoner so-and-so, your wife is waiting in the visitor's area. It didn't reach him, he was in the other part of the prison. And this prison officer never said where he was, he just kept quiet. Now the prisoner, please come. And by the time they located him, the prison visiting hours were over. And it is a stupid thing to do, but it's really cool. You don't have many privileges as a prisoner. When people treat you like that, you know, it just really hurt him. So he said, that's a dog. I said, great. Now, how many times do you see this dog every day? And he said that it was his job to actually to help clean up the office and also to give a cup of tea, a cup of coffee, or whatever that officer wanted. I said, great, this is marvelous. Now, see if you can be kind to the prison officer. I said, it's a waste of time. No, it never a waste of time, try it. So apparently he did that, and every time he made a cup of tea for the prison officer, or a cup of coffee, he really tried to get the best tea or the best coffee. And that milk, that honey or sugar, what do you want? And I said, really try and be kind. And every time you offer him a cup of tea, just say, I hope it's nice for you, sir. Or say some nice words. And so every week I would check out, how's it going? It says, hopeless. And said, I really go out of the way to find some biscuits for him, which I think he likes. And I give it to him and said, hope you like the biscuits, sir. He doesn't even recognize I exist. He just carries on doing whatever his work. I'm invisible to him. I carry on. And so it took about 3 months, I think. And I always remember the time when, after about 3 months, it could have been longer, but after 3 months or so, this prisoner was waiting for me. And he was so excited. It worked, it worked. I said, what? Oh, that prison officer. I gave him this special type of coffee. I said, I hope you like it, sir. And he didn't move his head or his arms or any part of his body except by saying, ugh. That grunt. He said, that's amazing. You wouldn't realize how important that was. He acknowledged I exist in the world. And I said, you got the crack is there. He said, the damn wall is going to break down soon. It took about another month, but it did. Here's a nice cup of tea, sir. I hope you like it. And he said, the prison officer turned around to him, looked him in the eye and said, thank you. And that was just, that blew his mind. And that apparently, it went all around the gossip in the prison system, in the grapevine. And all the prisoners, all the prisons in West Australia heard about that. According to him, he said that that prison officer would say thank you to somebody, to a prisoner, which is unbelievable. It works. It might take about 5 months, maybe even longer with your husband or your wife or the person you're working with. But it does work. That means you can sort of be kind to anybody. A challenge for you. If I hadn't made us like almost like a challenge, a bet or something, no money involved, but yeah, it can be done. No, it can't. Let's prove it. If I hadn't made that challenge, he would never have gone so far. He'd given up earlier, because he didn't give up. It did work. Next question, I'm curious about. Oh, that's weird, I think. Yeah, I'm curious about hierarchy actually works in a monastery. It's very simple, that this is our monastic rule, and some of you heard it before, that the head monk, the abbot, which is me, the abbot is always right. That's rule number one. And if the abbot makes a mistake, go back to rule number one. That's rule number two. Of course, that's not the way. How hierarchy? Does a junior monk have to do whatever any senior monk tells him? No. In any discussion by the junior monk seen as a lack of ego restraint? No. What, if any, place does obedience have in a Buddhist monastery? Most of all, you're obedient to the Vinaya, not to a person. Because sometimes you get a good senior monk, a good senior nun, sometimes one who's just learning the ropes. They're trying their very best. What should you do? It's one of the reasons I think I mentioned one of the things the Buddha said. After he passed away, let the suttas and the vinaya be your teacher, be your guide. So you check out, you know, what is the right thing to do. And if there is anything to decide, most cases, the whole Sangha meets. It's actually on Friday night. I might as well tell you now, you've got 2 days to hide, or to get sick, or to escape. But on Friday night, please excuse me, sisters, but you will be doing the Q&A. table. You can just ask them all sorts of nice, soft questions. But don't you want to sort of hear them say something? Ask them who they are, where they come from, or what they did, and why they became nuns, and why this, why that. It's a wonderful thing to do. It's only for the evening. Is he okay with that? Good. Going to have to go over to my Bodhinyana Monastery for the Patimokkha. Yeah, you just disappear and you're gone. But, yeah, so what happens is we have meetings to discuss. And we're supposed to only decide in unanimity. So discuss and discuss and discuss. And if there's one monk or one nun says, no, we don't want to do this, then you can't do it. What usually happens, though, that they say, oh, they're just, why am I saying no to this? And the other monk says, there's nothing evil or wrong about this. So come on, let's have harmony. And in any discussion by the junior monk, seen as lack of ego restraint, no, you invite everybody to have a say. That's what I always do over on those Friday nights. When it comes to the meeting of the community over there, if somebody doesn't say anything, I ask them, just how do you feel? That's the job of the person in charge, to make sure that everyone, is their opinions, is heard. Even if, you know, their opinion is a stupid opinion, or it's, you know, doesn't really, not considered by others, at least it has to be heard. So everyone has their view heard. And then afterwards, then we make a decision. Sometimes that we can't make a decision, get some more info, but then after a while, that usually people give in. And then we find a harmonious decision. It may not always be right, but it's right enough to go ahead with. And that's about it. When it comes to having to give the talks and having to stay after lunch to talk to people while other monks have just already gone back to their hut and having a nap or I don't know what they're up to, that has to be the monk or the nun in charge. So it's not all having a nice time being the boss monk. And if ever there's a meeting from the committee in town, it has to be the boss monk usually, has to go and do all that sort of stuff. So sometimes, and it's quite honest, sometimes the monks over at Bodhinyana Monastery, they make really sure that I'm in good health, out of selfishness. I just happened to be in Asia when the Christmas Boxing Day tsunami hit. And I was actually in Penang on that day the tsunami hit, just finishing a retreat over in Kuala Lumpur, and then flew up to Penang to give some talks. And the head monk at the time, who was looking after Bodhinyana Monastery, was Venerable Chittapala's brother. His name was Chittamala. And apparently I found out he was ringing all of these people in Penang. So where's Ajahn Brahm? Is Ajahn Brahm okay? And when I heard about that, I thought I didn't really realize how much he cared about me. He was just really went overboard trying to make sure I was okay and I wasn't washed away in the tsunami like many people were. And so when I got back a few days later, I said, I really didn't realize this, how much you cared about me. We said, well, you know, I'm a monk, I have to be honest. I was really, really concerned that if you were swept away and died, I'd have to take over. That's what he said. Anyway. Oh, now this is a good question because I've heard this many times. Dear Ajahn, one. A bodhisattva, supposed to be the Buddha, about, this is Western Dawn, Vaisantara, donated his young children to a needy couple who abused them to promote his letting go. Isn't this bad parenting, violating child rights? Yes, I totally agree with you there. But then they said, but, that was supposed to be in the story, the Dasa, the Ten Jataka tales, about the Buddha sort of completing his paramita before he became the Buddha. And that is almost a perfect example, which is very easy to prove, was not actually true, was added much later on. The idea of, now this is the Theravada 10 paramita. The Mahayana had 6 paramita. So they're pretty much the same. But why did Theravada have 10? The reason was that the Mahayana invented the idea of parami. There's nothing really wrong with it, but it's not ever said by the Buddha. And it came a couple of hundred years after the Buddha passed away. But when the Theravada heard, oh, these Mahayana have got a 6 parami, we'll have some too. But we'll have 10. Sometimes, you know what it's like in religious leaders, the hierarchies, they should just come down off their high perches, and just see what a stupid thing that was. And it makes no sense at all. You don't donate young children knowing that couple or that person was going to really abuse them. It's not about, if you have children, you have the responsibilities. You've got to care for them. So I totally agree with you there. It wasn't a bodhisattva. No bodhisattva would do that. How do you see euthanasia? Lord, WA, my opinion, must be in your advance care directive, especially for dementia people who end up as vegetables in aged care. They're not vegetables in aged care. Sort of. Aged care can be developed much more caringly. So many people, some of you may probably work in aged care or visit people in aged care, and sometimes that you don't just sit them in front of a TV or play bingo with them. Sometimes they say that music, which is has an emotional connection to them, and they come alive. And it's as if that everything else is boring them. It needs to be stimulated. And also, I sometimes like the idea of Singapore some years ago, when if your children have a house, I think within a kilometre or 2 kilometres of their parents, especially when their parents are old, then they get less council taxes, like rates we call them here, because they want to encourage the children to live close to your parents so you can look after them. And so your parents, one of the greatest things for grandparents to stop them getting old or stop them feeling old and getting demented is let them have your children to look after during the day. Because grandparents and children, they just love each other so well. I still remember my grandma. And any time of the day or night, I could go to her little flat, knock on the door, she'd, Peter, please come in. Do you want some chips? Like French fried, you know, potatoes. Says, oh yeah, I'll have some. And she'd make me as many as I wanted. And when my mother found out, she really sort of tried to scold my grandma. So what are you feeding him chips for? You know, that's bad for his health, and he's got a dinner coming this evening, he won't like his dinner. And my grandma always stood up for me. She said, if he wants some chips from me, he gets chips. End of story. And you've had experiences like that. You know, your grandmas, if you have a really nice grandma, she loves you to bits. My mother couldn't do anything. And so that kept them going and gave them something to do, some love, and the kids enjoyed. I really enjoyed being with grandpa and grandma. They were just different than being with your mum and dad. So it's lovely to have that. So anyway, for euthanasia, you know, someone told me, he was a Sri Lankan fellow from Melbourne, he says, euthanasia is not the problem. It's youth all over the world. Oh, come on. Youth in Asia, or youth all over the world. But euthanasia was, one must never, it's not your right to kill another human being, but It's also not your right to stop them if that's the decision they make. So as long as it is what they call voluntary euthanasia, which can be done. So you make your choice. And you, obviously there's some safeguards so you don't kill yourself out of just depression. But, you know, you make clear choices in your right mind. You say that I'd rather die this way. And you do it. You know, in a nice, calm, peaceful way. Because remember, just as a Buddhist monk, you have all these moral decisions to advise on. And so at one of our conferences we did, I personally invited Dr. Nitschke from Exit International to actually just give a talk and answer questions. What is euthanasia? What happens? What do you do? And that was wonderful. Instead of saying, oh, it's bad, find out first of all. And that's what we did. And I was really quite impressed that when you do a euthanasia, that, you know, you're in full control. The person who's administering this toxic, whatever it is, into your veins, you have all these buttons you have to press. You're the only one who can do it. And, you know, many times you're asked, if you do this one, you get closer until you make the final push of this button. And then you have what they said was a painless death. And it's your choice. As I said the other day when people asked me about this and they're serious about this, there are some monks in the time of the Buddha who committed suicide. You have to put it that way. They ended their life faculty. And the Buddha said it's blameless for them. So you can see that, you know, there is arguments for that. And as a Buddhist monk, I can never tell you what to do. I can never criticize you for what you do. But then when we talk about euthanasia, we also have to talk about abortion as well. And why are some people so strict? Oh, you know, euthanasia is bad or something. But then they don't want abortion either. And a lot of the times those are male religious leaders. I often comment, and I think it's a fair comment, that on how does a man, even if they're supposedly wise, how can a man know what it's like to have an abortion? And all the times which I've listened to many people who come to our centre who've had abortions, you listen there and it really hurts them. It's never anything you do easily. But it's always the least worst of two options. It's all you can do. And so I know as a Buddhist monk, if any of you sort of, you know, come up and say, look, I'm pregnant, I decided, should I have an abortion? I can never tell you what to do, but I can tell you how to make a decision with kindness. And I said to many women, you know, beforehand, I said, whichever you choose, you know, I'll always be kind to you. And, you know, you'll never ever be banned from any centre which I'm involved in. You can always, you know, it's a difficult decision, and morally, it's just right on the edge there. You can't really say. I know it's hard, difficult, many, many things you take into consideration. But please don't make your decisions out of fear. You'll always have a supporter in our Buddhist society, whichever way you go. So that's the only thing which you can really do to give the kindest compassion. And realize that I can't tell you. But I know there's many women here who've had abortions. That's why you're very silent now. Please. No punishment, no worry about that. So don't be hard upon yourself. Guys are involved, but we get off really easily. Be careful. But if it happens, sometimes you just, that's what you have to do. I know sometimes people who do have abortions, usually when they're young, and it's just, it's going to be terrible for the kid when it sort of grows up and when you're not really ready to care for it. So sometimes they decide on those abortions. I said, later on, always remember that if a kid really wants to come into your life, they'll have another try later. But that great story of one of our members here, they're not here this evening, but you know, you know them, they come to Nolamara regularly. And first pregnancy she had in her marriage, and unfortunately a couple of days before birth, the kid twisted in the womb and so blocked off its blood supply in the umbilical cord. So to the surprise of everyone, it was stillborn. And everything else was fine, but just it was stillborn. And I remember that because actually it was in your funeral parlour before you went there. You weren't sort of working there then. But I remember going there because they had the coffin standing almost vertical so that little Charlie could get in the family photograph. And I was in the family photograph as well. And you know, there was not that much, you know, it's really sad, but not that much grief. What I never saw was that when I was looking another direction, the funeral directors were looking another direction, that the mother and father got a little biro pen out and put a line on the baby's heel, a mark there. And the old tradition was that if that child is going to come back, they'll have that as a birthmark. And that child did. It was incredible to see. I didn't think it was going to happen, but he said, yeah, it happened. And, okay, I've been talking about abortions and stuff, and just the women do it much harder, so I'm going to give you a little boost here now. And when it came back again, when it was died, they'd already given it a name, Charlie, as a male. When it came back, what usually happens, if for some reason it doesn't work the first time, such as that kid that just twisted in the womb and cut off its blood supply. So it did come back again. He saw the new kid, you know, with the not the scar, but the thing on its heel, and it was a girl. Because often, if something unfortunate happens, sort of to make up to it, the new kid has an upgrade. Okay. But anyway, so if a person does have euthanasia, because it's such a difficult situation, and you get pregnant again later on, how many times is that same kid comes back? First time couldn't make it, wrong time. Next time it does come back. It's your kid. Reincarnation. It comes back to you. Happens. Anyway, please excuse me. I said only a few questions, and what's happened. So that's an important topic. When you've had that taste of deep meditation, good enough to blow your hair off, how do you get back to beginner's mind? Exactly, the beginner's mind is in the present moment. So, you know, you just go back into this present moment. You can't want anything, it's a desire which causes the problem. The wanting. So you sit there, okay, I've had a good meditation this retreat. That's enough. Crikey, some people haven't got any good meditation at all. So what should I want more than this? So just sit here nice and comfortable and just bask in the afterglow of wisdom, that be content and easily satisfied. I don't want any more. This is good enough for me this time. And of course, then those things come back again. Because you're creating the causes of peace and contentment, no wanting. Thank you from all of us. This is the drawing here. I don't recognize this person in the drawing. All of us, what? These little balls with glasses on. Must be the ghosts here. No, it's very nice. Thank you so much. Dear Ajahn Brahm, when we die, what enters the wheel of samsara? When you die, it's like your body dies and your stream of consciousness continues on, like a stream. You look up on a bridge at a stream underneath. The water looks the same today as it did yesterday, but it's totally different water. What's under the yesterday has flowed closer to the sea. What's here today has come from the hills or the mountains somewhere. So that's the simile the Buddha said about the stream of consciousness. It's not the same, not different. So what enters this wheel of samsara is just the stream of consciousness. How did the Buddha know that the king's wife was a beetle for a day before going to the heavenly realms? What was his identifying from her being? It's just the stream of consciousness. So it's not a sense of a body, but this will and consciousness as a stream, always changing. Can you please give some suggestions, please? As I get into deep meditation or longer, my breath is slowed and I can't feel much. Good, excellent. It comes back after some time. Is there any other object to concentrate when breath is slowed down? What's left? Sometimes it's a simile like you go out of a lit room into the garden, and because it takes a while for your pupils of your eyes to open up, first of all you can't see very much. But you just stay there, peaceful, and then after a while the pupils dilate and you can see much more in your garden. Different intensity of light. So what happens here, the different intensity of those phenomena means that often when the breath starts to disappear, if you've not got too much mindfulness at the time, it means that tense, you don't know what to watch. What's left? There must be something there. And the best way of doing that is to make sure that when the breath disappears, it's also got some joy in it, some happiness, some piti sukha, as the Buddha said in his Anapanasati Sutta. Because if you've got the joy and the happiness there, the energy there, when the breath disappears, what's left is the joy and the happiness. And often that appears as nimittas. So it's not what you're supposed to be concentrating on. Whatever's in front of your mind right now, the Emperor's Three Questions, now is the most important time. Whatever is in front of you is the most important thing in the whole world, especially when the breath starts to disappear. What's in front of you right now? And care about it. Is it okay for me to feel my both arms heavy? I can feel them, but they're almost not moving, and surroundings are peaceful, no sounds. What does the experience mean? What the experience means is when your mind starts to get peaceful, your mindfulness increases, the energy is increasing, and it's like you amplify any physical feelings in your body. So things may feel like heavy, they may feel stiff, they may feel like itchy, like cording with ants or something. There's no ants on you at all, your body is still the same weight. You haven't eaten any more baked beans while you've been meditating, so the weight is the same. All it really means is just the perceptions start to mess around a bit. But it's totally safe. After it starts to feel heavy, then you find the body totally disappears. Can I do backwards walking meditation? I won't stop you, but I won't advise it, because otherwise you won't know where the door is. And I don't know what you might bump into. So you do the forwards. If you really want to, you can do two steps forward, one step back, two steps forward, one step back. But anyway, just do it nice and easily, because easily, simply, as you're walking, it does actually mean that you're focusing on the movement of your feet, and it should be not that hard to keep awake and lots of meditation, mindfulness. Dear Ajahn, in interview you said when you're sitting with tiredness, you give your tiredness to the Buddha. Please can you speak more on this? Today I notice how much tension this body carries. It is like a metal pipe coiled around the body. This tension seems to be related to the sloth and torpor contributing to tiredness. Tension also seems to be a close companion to fear, another emotion that leads to exhaustion with love, respect and gratitude. I always remember the fellow who went to see his therapist, and he said that I've had these visions. Sometimes I really think I'm a marquee. You know what a marquee is, don't you? You know, just sometimes they use them in big events. He said, sometimes I feel I'm a teepee, like a wigwam. I get these visions, I'm a marquee or a teepee. And the therapist said, oh yeah, I know your state, it's very common. You're too tense. Oh, thank you so much. But a lot of times that when I said I give my tiredness to the Buddha, I didn't actually say that. What I meant was that sometimes when I start meditating, I say, I'm going to give this meditation, donate this period as my dana to the Buddha. It's an offering, doing dana. There's many ways you can do dana. You know, you can give money into a box. You can just give food. And sometimes people do that to the Buddha. They put flowers or incense in front of the Buddha. And here you're giving a period of meditation to the Buddha. It's dana. I give half an hour sitting here, and this half an hour is dedicated to the Buddha. I like that because I'm not doing anything. It's nothing for me. It's giving it to somebody else. So that helps to get very peaceful. Anyway, I'm going fast now because I went really slow, first of all. Dear Ajahn, in the sutta today, Wednesday, there were mention of profoundly still states and insights into the impersonal, uncertain nature of things, beyond the experience of most people. Without the actual experience to reflect on, there seems to be a risk of mere reasoning and the hindrance of negativity to everything. Devoid ill will taking the place of true wisdom, should we just reflect and try to understand the nature of things as taught by the Buddha based on whatever our experience is so far? One of the reasons why I don't mind teaching just really deep Dhamma, even if it may feel to be such a long way away from you and even just unexplainable, way too far for you, what happens is that those things stick in your mind and the seed is planted, and years later, maybe even next lifetime, I really mean this, years later, you get into a deep meditation, you have a really deep sense of peace and stillness, and you remember what these instructions are. You make sense of them. And that leads to your enlightenment. These are just like little, like in the Australian deserts, little seeds which are just waiting for the rainfall to germinate. And they just stay there. It was weird for me to see stuff like that happening when many of the teachings said by Ajahn Chah didn't understand at all at the time. And of course I thought the teacher was crazy. But nevertheless, even though I tried to forget those teachings, you couldn't do. And later on you got some deep meditations and these ideas came up and said, wow, I remember Ajahn Chah teaching that years ago. I haven't even thought of it for the last 5 or 6 years. And simply because you realize that those things are put in there for when the right time and place comes, then they will appear. That's one of the reasons why we say all this stuff. And it's also great that you can see the amount of joy which comes up, and the reasoning, the five khandhas, the components of existence are not you, not mind, not a self. And little by little, as that goes deeper into you, you find it's much easier to let go. You don't own anything anyway. So letting go is what's being encouraged. Renunciation. When you're meditating, you're just letting go. And that's a great way to get into deep meditation. When people bow to a Buddha statue, to what qualities might they be bowing to? Yeah, that's the story behind that. I'm going to tell the whole story because it was inspiring to me and a great memory which I have that got to know many people in different walks of life, and one when I was helping with the Cancer Support Association. It changed names many times. It's now called Solaris, over in Cottesloe. And one of the other people who used to go there, he was a Father Frank, not Frank Sheehan, but he was one of the chaplains. He was a chaplain at Christchurch Grammar School here in Perth. And Christchurch Grammar School is, if you've ever been there, it's a beautiful sight overlooking the Swan River in Claremont. And it's an incredible sight. So he invited me, can you please come and give a talk to the kids one morning? I said, no, yeah, why not? So I went there in the morning, really early, to beat the traffic, to get there before the day began. And it was Frank Sheehan. Frank Brennan. Brennan, thank you, yeah. Sheehan was the Jesuit. So Frank Brennan, and he met me there, and with the principal as well. This was a top Anglican school. And the principal said, look, I'm an Anglican. I'm a practicing Christian. And so this is a Christian school. But we're very happy that you're coming here to talk to our kids. But he said, when all the kids are settled down, when we walk into the school, we do a little bow to the statue of Jesus in the main hall. But he said, you're a Buddhist, you don't have to bow to the statue of Jesus, you're a Buddhist. And you know the story, that I stood my ground and I said, I demand my right to bow to your statue of Jesus. And I just overdid it, but that really got his attention. And then I explained why. I can see something in that statue which inspires me. And to that, I'm going to bow. And then I explained to him why we bow to Buddha statues in Buddhist monasteries. And I explained that to the kids. That was the first part of my talk. So when I bow to a Buddha statue, this is just me. It's up to you what you want to do. But I always bow to virtue, first of all. To goodness, trustworthiness, honesty. Because that's really important. And every time you bow to it, as someone said today, when you bow to something, it means you respect it so highly. It's bigger than your ego, so you make sure you always remember to be as virtuous as you possibly can. And the second bow is to peace. The peace of meditation, which is gorgeous. And also the peace in this place. Peace in the world, peace in your family. Peace and stillness. The world is too noisy. So I value and worship peace. The last one is usually to kindness, compassion, sometimes to wisdom, but I always focus on kindness more. Because I've seen such wonderful acts of kindness and how beautiful, how uplifting it is. That's my source of inspiration, joy, almost like called entertainment, in a beautiful way. So that's what I bow to, for virtue, peace and compassion. And the kids, especially the principal, understood it. Understood why I could bow to, I see something in that Jesus which I could aspire to. And respect and worship. I see something in the Buddha statue which I worship, the virtue, peace and compassion. And then, you know, the principal was really impressed. And so, you know, they organised a trip from people in the kids in the school to come to Bodhinyana Monastery. And so even the principal came. He came in his own car. And I met him at the gate and just and said, please come in. The kids are coming any moment now. And he just had a nice chat. He said, a nice chat. He said, I'll show you our main hall. So he came in the main hall, took off his shoes. And I wish there was a camera there. The two of us, next to one another, we bowed to the big Buddha statue there. I never asked him. He understood why. As a practicing Christian, as a well-known Christian, how wonderful it was just to bow to a statue of Buddha. When many sort of Western Buddhists don't want to do that. He understood why, the reason. It's lovely to do that. Dear Ajahn, could you please tell the story about sitting quietly by the lake and watching the animals as they come to drink there? Yeah. You have to sit really quietly, otherwise the animals won't come. really quietly, absolutely quietly, and then the animals come. The breath is gone, the mind is peaceful, there is no nimitta, what should I do now? Nothing. That was the mistake. What should I do now? Don't do anything. Leave it alone. Is free will delusion? Yes. Of course, it's just will. Is it really free? That's scary. But there's so many examples of this. There's one which really sort of shocked me. Was when the Psychic Research Society, we always get a hypnotist every year to do a demonstration. And not just for entertainment, but just to go deeply into it. What actually is it? Why does it work? And there's always one person who's very easy to hypnotize, and this poor student. They're all, you know, even I was just, I don't mind making a fool of myself, you know, for the sake of science, but you know, I wasn't a good subject. So they had about four or five people hypnotized, one student really deeply. And what they did, they made a suggestion to him while he was under hypnosis. The hypnotist said, when I touch my right earlobe, then it doesn't matter what's going on in the auditorium, you must stand up and sing the British National Anthem from beginning to end in a loud voice. God save the Queen. And he said, now, but when you come out of hypnosis, you won't remember that instruction, but you'll follow it. And so he did that, and of course he didn't know what was said. And all his friends, no way were we going to tell him. I wanted to find out whether this actually worked. And sooner or later the hypnotist touched his right earlobe. And this young student got up in the middle of the audience, and he started singing, God save! In a loud voice. And we were killing ourselves laughing. The whole audience was bursting out. It was the students. And we thought the funniest thing we'd ever seen for weeks. And he just, that didn't stop him. He just did the whole thing. And at the end of singing the British National Anthem, he sat down. And the person who was the lecturer, he asked us all to be quiet. And he asked his student, why did you do that? Why did you, you know, study for no reason at all, stand up and sing the British National Anthem? And this student, intelligent young man, gave this credible answer. It made it up for me, it made it clear to me that in his opinion, that was total free will. He freely chose to do something which was so unusual, unneeded, so weird, but he decided to do it. And that scared me. For him, he could not make any distinction between what had been conditioned into him and what we all think of as free will. But we knew it was conditioned into him. How many times when you buy something, are you really free will when you go down the items to buy in the shopping mall? Are you had any free will coming here this evening? Could you have stayed in your room? Of course you couldn't, that's why you're here. It's scary because sometimes, my goodness, what actually did I decide to do and not decide to do? Things like fashion. Now why do you dye your hair or have no hair like you do? Why? Did you really freely choose that? And after a while you find, even like cuddling teddy bears, what are you doing that for? Did you have any free choice about that? So sometimes we really start to be concerned about what this thing will is. But don't worry so much that Ajahn Brahm and the nuns were very benign. You see other people have been here and you're all sort of reasonably healthy and happy and things go well for you in life. So because of that, you don't have to worry too much. But what we are doing, and I honestly admit this, is brainwashing. Ajahn Chah did that to me. Thank you, Ajahn Chah, for brainwashing me. And I'm now doing that to you. I admit it, brainwashing you in a beautiful way. So you become better human beings, kinder, and you get into some of these amazing experiences. And you will do that to the people you meet as well. That's how the Dharma spreads. Not from free will, but just through conditioning, cause and effect. So anyway, there is no free will according to the Buddha's teachings. Will, not me, not mine, not a self. Cause and effect, that's all. Was emptiness, sunyata, taught by the Buddha, or was it a later concept? No, that was taught by the Buddha. How does it fit in with other teachings like the Four Noble Truths or Dukkha, Anicca, Anatta? Because when these things all vanish, when Dukkha, Anicca, Anatta vanish, Nibbana is sunya. There's nothing left. It's gone. Finished. Empty. Yay! I like emptiness. Have you ever noticed that emptiness has come for two interviews so far? Sunya. I shouldn't say this, should I? If ever you look at the list of people having interviews, sometimes you see at the very end, Sunya. Have you ever seen him or her? No, but anyway, I wrote that down for them so I can have one less interview because I was tired. So Sunya, and I'm not lying, nobody came. No, Sunya, nothing. I love Sunya. Okay, it's 8:23. Are you really getting really tired?
No.
Yeah. Some of people, okay. So I'll leave two for tomorrow. Very good. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.